This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have fired University of Illinois professor Stephen Salida.
Salida was fired for protesting the last Gaza war. However, he's been supported by thousands and thousands across the country. 6,000 professors have boycotted the University of Illinois in protest.
We'll also speak with returning guest Dr. Stephen Saltz, the psychologist active in the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology.
We had Stephen on before in 2011 when he was protesting and going after the American Psychological Association for allowing its psychologists to participate in structuring enhanced interrogation techniques, torture, detention, etc. He's back on it again as James Risen's new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War, takes on the American Psychological Association for its involvement in Bush torture programs.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, I've been reading about a international real estate company called REMAX that's been selling parts of Palestine. What's behind this?
They certainly are, Michael, and we'll bring our listeners' attention to a Code Pink campaign to try and boycott or go after this company called REMAX, R-E/MAX, maybe the biggest real estate company in the world. I don't mean ownership, but I mean agents. They're in 90 countries. They're gigantic. I'm sure you've seen their balloons, etc., at various open houses around the United States and around the world. They're big. Well, interestingly enough, they also are so big that they even have an office in the occupied territories, not in Gaza, but in the West Bank.
They're selling the West Bank?
I don't think they're selling homes to Palestinians. I think they're selling homes to what we call settlers or Israelis, and that is correct. Not think, that's what they're doing there. And they have an office in the West Bank, and that's what they do. I mean, it's sort of unimaginable that they do that. They're selling properties not only that are in Israel, which I think are, many of us think they shouldn't be doing that, but they're selling properties in the West Bank. They're doing business, according to a recent long article in Mondo Weiss, which I recommend to people. They're doing business in all of the major West Bank settlements.
I think we should point out that the West Bank was captured and is being held by Israel illegally since 1967. So they're selling parts of other people's property.
Yeah, I've talked about this, and we have on the show before, that there's some 500,000 Jewish settlers living in the West Bank, I guess if you include East Jerusalem as well as the West Bank itself. Every single one of those settlers is there illegally because under the Fourth Geneva Convention, it's called Article 49, it prohibits an occupying power, i.e. Israel, from transferring citizens from its own territory to the occupied territory. So completely illegal. Every settlement is illegal. Every piece of land they've taken is illegal. And yet you have this real estate company, headquarters in the United States, selling parts of that West Bank to settlers. And what's interesting, Richard Falk, who was the UN Special Rapporteur for the United Nations on the Palestine territories, said not only does it create huge human rights abuses, but, and this is a quote from Richard Falk, the selling by REMAX contributes to the commission of the international crime of transferring citizens of the occupying power onto occupied territory. So he's essentially saying they're participating in an international crime. It's pretty outrageous. Now, as I said, Code Pink has called for a campaign against REMAX. It's called, quote, Boycott REMAX, No Open Homes on Stolen Land. They were in touch with the REMAX headquarters. The REMAX headquarters said, look, this is just a franchise. We can't tell every franchise. One of the operators said to them, this is like calling up McDonald's headquarters and saying you didn't like a hamburger, you know, in Brazil or something. What are we going to do about that? But of course, they can do a lot about it. Is their franchise? They're profiting from that franchise. They can decide that franchise is not one they want to have. Finally, REMAX did issue a statement saying, they said it's an autonomous franchise, essentially, but they also said there's only one REMAX office remaining in the West Bank. And RE/MAX, now they're saying, is exploring options for this office, which means the campaign is already started to work. They know they can't take a chance because I think the Code Pink campaign, I'm not sure what it's doing next, but, you know, they have open houses all over the world. You can imagine pro-Palestinian people going to those open houses. They can't be stopped. They go into the open houses and they unfurl a sign that says, stolen land, RE/MAX selling it. So I think this is a good campaign. To find out about it, you can go to the Mondo Weiss site, but also you can, of course, go to the Code Pink site and find out about how to join the campaign against RE/MAX in the West Bank. And I urge you strongly to do so.
Well, the campaign against SodaStream, which was operating out of the West Bank, they had to get out of there. And I think this one's got a good chance of winning.
Michael, I'm really glad you brought that up because, again, Code Pink actually began the campaign against SodaStream. And just a couple of weeks ago, had a victory. And, you know, it's true that they did a huge amount. And, you know, then that famous actor decided she'd rather speak for the SodaStream in the West Bank than for Oxfam. What was her name again? Scarlett Johansson. And now, of course, she must really have mud on her face because now they're pulling out of SodaStream. She gave up her Oxfam contract and she looks terrible. And in fact, of course, what I think happened is PepsiCo bought SodaStream. And I think they just said,
yeah,
we can't own something in the West Bank because it's too hot.
Yeah.
So now they're moving SodaStream out of the West Bank. Now, I'm not going to tell you what other item to buy because I don't recommend what items you need if you want to make fizzy water. But I did ask the people at Code Pink the other day whether I could now buy a SodaStream. And they said, still don't buy a SodaStream. So there's other companies that said they make even better items for fizzing your water if that's what you care about.
Michael, last week, the USA Freedom Act went down, the Act on Surveillance. What's that all about?
Well, what it's about, Michael, is the question of what happened with Ed Snowden's revelations and how is our wonderful government and Congress reacting to it. Now, of course, all the headlines say defeated by Republicans. Apparently, almost everyone, if not every Democrat, voted for it. And then, two, the Democrats needed 60 votes to get it through, so it cloture or whatever couldn't hold it up. They got 58. They blamed two Republicans for doing it, which, you know, mildly true. But there's two things we have to look at. How good was the act and what's Obama done? Well, the act, even a lot of people who want to slow down surveillance were against it. I mean, all the people who were real whistleblowers, Thomas Drake, Bill Binney, Ed Loomis, Kirk Wiebe, they opposed the USA Freedom Act, fearing its vague legislative wording about what constitutes connection between various people on call records could actually increase NSA authority. Let me say what it's about. We all know about the collection of metadata by the NSA. That's where they get all of what we do on our phones, who we call, how long we call for, where we call from, all that metadata. They put it then in these grids, and they're allowed to do 2, 3, 4 jumps. So if I call my co-host Michael Smith here, they can actually look who Michael Smith calls. That's 2 jumps. Then they can look who those people call, the whole tree. I mean, the bill was, I think, going to limit it to 2 jumps, which is quite broad, of course, because let's say I call 100 people. Each of those 100 people, they're going to be able to look at to get the metadata. And each of those 100, they can then look at all those calls. So we're actually talking about thousands of metadata calls. That's one reason people didn't love the new legislation, because it was still going to allow that to happen. It was supposedly going to be kept by the private telephone companies, quote, private telephone companies, and then the NSA was going to have to get that information afterwards. But it was not a great bill. It was way watered down. The administration watered it down. Everybody watered it down. Everybody held their nose who wanted it and said, well, I guess it's the best we can do. We better pass it. But as you see, whistleblowers said this is actually worse. Let's say it was marginally better. But of course, you were going to get the feeling that the government had done something, but in fact had done nothing. But even this, they couldn't get through. This had actually the support of the NSA, roughly. What I understand is support of the NSA, support of Google and places like that, because obviously it was a bill without teeth. But even a bill without teeth couldn't do it. Now, one thing I should say, and this is, I think, a very important point, Obama administration said it wanted the bill passed, right? But let's think about what's going on here. Right now, the NSA and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court has interpreted the law to allow this kind of collection of metadata. And the question is, so what? They've interpreted it that way, and then they apply for these various kind of things from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, et cetera, and they get the authority to go ahead and take all our metadata. But the question is, does the NSA have to do that? The law doesn't say, NSA, you have to get Michael Smith's metadata or Michael Ratner's metadata or Heidi Boghossian's metadata. It says, if you want to. So the question is Obama. Obama says, yes, he wants this legislation after he waters it down. But let me just say, as we speak, today, tomorrow, next week, he could just direct the NSA not to collect the metadata. He could say it. He's the president. There's no requirement the NSA collect the metadata. So this is really outrageous. They're blaming the Republicans. They're blaming this legislation for this weak piece of junk. And Obama tomorrow, who speaks pious words with absolutely no meaning, could tomorrow, today, stop the NSA from getting the metadata. Let me end on this. One thing the Guardian says, and this is the point I'm really making, is it's really up to Obama. He doesn't need legislation to stop the NSA. And what they say, and I'll read the quote from the Guardian because it's a good one, quote, another open question is whether the Obama administration will seek from the secret FISA court another 90-day extension of the bulk domestic phone records dragnet when its existing authorization expires on 11 December, end quote. Well, the Guardian calls it an open question. I don't think it's an open question. Of course he's going to approve it. But I just want our listeners to understand, yeah, yell about the Republicans, yell about some conservative Democrats, yell about the sellouts by everybody on this legislation. But in the end, tomorrow, next week, certainly December 11th, the president does not have to reauthorize the bulk collection of domestic phone records.
Professor Stephen Salida is a distinguished scholar. As a relatively young man, he has already written 6 books. His specialty is white settler colonialism, here and abroad. His Palestinian grandmother was driven from her village in the 1948 Nakba in Palestine. He grew up in Kentucky, attended the University of Oklahoma, and was a tenured professor at Virginia Tech. He was then hired by the prestigious American Indian Studies program at the University of Illinois after being solicited by the faculty and vetted by the faculty. He signed a contract, gave up his job, as did his wife Diana, gave up his home, and was about to move to Illinois with his 2-year-old son. He was given classes to teach, ordered books, and was hosted at a new faculty reception. Then, during the Israeli military attack on Gaza last summer, where over 500 children were killed, Stephen Salida, on his private account, tweeted several sarcastic and even vulgar comments. His tweets were monitored by Israeli government supporters. Wealthy donors to the university and Zionist activists pressured the University of Illinois' Chancellor Phyllis Wise. Through a Freedom of Information Act request, we know the identity of one of those people. We'll find out more. Chancellor Wise then fired Professor Salida. Christopher Kennedy, the chairman of the Board of Trustees of the University of Illinois, said, quote, we don't want him around here, and led the board in an 8-1 vote to not confirm his hire. Professor Salida is being supported by an unprecedented avalanche of backers who understand the stakes. Over 6,000 professors have vowed to boycott the university. The American Association of University Professors and the Modern Language Association and the American Studies Association have come out in his support. This is the most important case involving free speech, freedom of association, and faculty self-governance to come along since the 1967 Keishian case, where the Supreme Court outlawed the loyalty oath. Professor Salida is being represented by the Center for Constitutional Rights, its senior attorney, Maria LaHood, its director of litigation, Bahir Azmi, and by cooperating attorneys in Chicago, the firm of Lovey & Lovey, by Anand Swami Nathan. Professor Salida, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
let's go all the way back to the beginning. You've got quite an unusual family background. And before we get into your being fired by the University of Illinois, let's talk about where it all started. Tell us about your grandparents. I know your grandmother was a Palestinian. You have a Nicaraguan in your family. Tell us about where you came from.
Sure. Well, it's simple enough on my father's side. He's a Jordanian from a town called Madaba. And so, as they call themselves, they're Jordanians. That means not of Palestinian origin. And my mom is born and raised in Nicaragua to Palestinian immigrant parents. And her mom was born in Palestine, and she was part of the 48 Nakba. And her father was an immigrant to Latin America.
Your parents, did they grow up here or in Nicaragua?
My dad in Jordan, my mom in Nicaragua. They were both immigrants to the U.S.
And where were you born?
I was born in West Virginia.
That's the damnedest thing I have to say. Where were you educated, and what did you come to specialize in?
I got my undergraduate and master's degree from a small regional college in Southwest Virginia called Radford University, and I got my PhD in Native American Studies from the University of Oklahoma. And my interest in Native American Studies developed from a Native American novel course I took in college, and it generated a sort of just a profound interest in the histories of settlement and dispossession in North America, which struck me as similar in important ways to the forms of dispossession that Palestinians have suffered in the Middle East.
I understand that the program in Indigenous Studies at the University of Illinois is one of the prestigious departments in America. It came to pass that they recruited you. Tell us a story about your interaction with the professors there at the University of Illinois and what led to their offering you a job on the faculty, a tenured job there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a terrific department with a prestigious international reputation, and it really is filled with outstanding scholars and teachers and advocates. I submitted my application actually in October of 2012. I was offered the job in September of 2013, signed the contract in October of 2013, so over a year ago. And that contract, of course, was countersigned by university officials, and it was made formal. And and at that point, it was announced that I had accepted the job and all was ready to move forward. But the process was all nearly 2 years old from the moment of. 2 years long, excuse me, from the moment of the submission of the application until the signing of the contract. And within that long time frame, there was an intense vetting process, as there is with any tenured faculty hire.
That was you anticipated my next question, Steve. What is that vetting process, and how does that relate to the concept of faculty joint governance?
Yeah, they normally, any search process in the humanities or social sciences starts with a search committee of anywhere from 4 to 6 people. They'll look over a candidate's cover letter. They'll examine a candidate's scholarship, and they'll examine that scholarship in detail. They'll examine the candidate's teaching dossier, teaching history, letters of recommendation. So it's a difficult process, not a simple process applying for an academic job. And then once the search committee has made its selection, it has to go to other committees throughout the university, a committee composed of representatives from the college. In my case, that would be the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. And then a committee composed of representatives of departments across the entire university. Because I was coming in with tenure, I also had to be vetted by external referees, anywhere from 4 to 6. They basically read all of my scholarship. I had to send them all of my books, all of my scholarly articles, my teaching dossier, and they have to write letters saying whether they believe this guy is worthy of tenure at an institution like the University of Illinois. So a profound number of eyeballs looked over my application and had to approve of my hire before the contract ever could have gone out.
And subsequent to that, when you were really en route to the university, the war against the people in Gaza broke out, as was your longtime practice, you commented on that. Talk to us about your view of the Israeli war on Gaza and what you said and how that led to the cancellation of your contract.
It was profoundly violent, that attack, to the point of appearing purely punitive, that they wanted to punish as many people as possible and inflict violence on as many people as possible. And given the statements that Israeli leaders have made about mowing the lawn in Gaza and putting the people of Gaza on a diet, and their longstanding discourse about demographic threats and a surplus of Palestinians, and the many debates that happen in the Knesset about how best to ensure a Jewish majority in perpetuity, it's hard not to think about those statements and those debates when Israel carpet bombs an area twice the size of Washington, D.C. and land area that's also home to 1.8 million people. You can't help but think that it's a sort of violence that's informed by something much worse than mere military strategy.
You tweeted your comments on that, some of them terse, some of them, I would imagine, offensive to political supporters of the government of Israel. Tell us what happened next.
A right-wing website run by, at least nominally, by Tucker Carlson, the bow-tied gentleman formerly of Crossfire. He's like he came out of a Republican lab. You know, he wears a bow tie, his name is Tucker, you know, and his website, the Daily Caller, you know, ended up publishing, you know, a standard right-wing hit piece, right? We've seen them all, the kind of stuff that David Horowitz's site does, you know, Salida, his tweets are horrible, blah, 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 blah. And oh, by the way, he's going to need to start a job at the University of Illinois. And so they were kind of hammering that point home. And then the local rag in Urbana-Champaign, the News Gazette, picked up on the Daily Caller story, and from that point forward, the controversy just sort of, it gained steam, and the next thing I know, I'm receiving an unceremonious termination letter from the chancellor.
What did she tell you was her reason for firing you?
She didn't give a reason. She only said that she didn't expect trustee approval, so there was no need to show up.
Well, later on, didn't they say they thought that you were, quote, uncivil?
They called me uncivil, and then it morphed into anti-Semitic.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think that comes to the crux of the matter, because uncivil is a loaded term in the history of the United States. Initially was used against the savages that the European settlers encountered here. They were uncivil. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a term that's deeply rooted in colonial violence. It's a term that always implies something sinister without ever having to explain, right? You know, its intent or its meaning. So it's a wonderful term for shutting down debate and discrediting somebody without having to justify or explain that position. You know, the entire Southern Hemisphere was colonized based on notions that they were uncivilized. North American continent, was colonized based on these same discourses. So for the University of Illinois administration to invoke the language of civility and incivility in its crushing of faculty autonomy in the American Indian Studies program tells us just how much a colonial logic predominates in the American bureaucratic imagination.
And the slander or libel, one is oral, one is written, against you, saying you're anti-Semitic, was really effective because, in my experience, they conflate the actions of the government of Israel and the people who criticize those actions as anti-Semitic. And how was that used against you?
For the same reason, based on the same conflation that you mention, I've criticized strongly in some cases the government of the state of Israel and the policies of the state of Israel and the colonial presence of the state of Israel, but never have I and never would I condemn Jews as a people or as a cultural group or as a religious group, however you want to categorize it. But it's precisely because of the conflation that I ended up saddled with this label of anti-Semite, and it's a conflation of anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, and that conflation is problematic. And I was pointing out why that conflation is problematic in the first place, and that's what seems to have upset so many people.
The amount of support that you've garnered in the United States is unprecedented, really historic. And I wanted to talk to you about that. You're here in New York, of course, on a tour, explaining your case at some of the major universities, both in New York City and in New Jersey. You were in Princeton, you're going to Columbia, you were at NYU. And the number of people coming out to show support for you is really phenomenal. But I wanted to ask you about that. I know the AAUP, the Association of American University Professors, for example. But tell us the various organizations and individuals who come out to support you. And then I want to ask you about what's at stake here.
Okay. Yeah, the support has been phenomenal. There's, besides the AAUP, which you already mentioned, 16 departments at the University of Illinois have voted no confidence in the chancellor and in the board of trustees. I've also received support from the Center for Constitutional Rights, of course, the Modern Language Association, the American Historical Association, a number of trade unions have passed resolutions condemning the university's decision and demanding my reinstatement. So the support really cuts across civic groups, legal groups, academic groups, and then, of course, activist groups such as Jewish Voice for Peace, Adalah, and so forth.
We are speaking with Professor Stephen Salida, who is on tour here in New York and in New Jersey, explaining his case to many, many people on campuses, television, on the radio show Law and Disorder. Stephen, I wanted to talk to you about what's at stake and preface it with a sentence out of a letter that one of your attorneys, the legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights, Bahir Azmi, wrote to Chancellor Phyllis Wise, the woman that fired you. And Attorney Azmi said in his letter to her, "In taking such precipitous action, you have sent the anti-democratic message to your faculty and students that censorship, rather than engagement, reflection, or critique, is an appropriate response when political orthodoxy is challenged. The Supreme Court warned against such self-defeating academic censorship, which previously arose during the McCarthy era." What is your reflection on that?
Oh, I think Mr. Azmi puts it very eloquently, that there around this issue particularly, although there are other constellation of issues that tend to have similar effects, you know, the impulse seems to be to shut down the debate and the discussion before it even begins, right? Let's not even have the debate in the first place. And that kind of response to a controversial position contravenes the very purpose of the university as the site of debate and struggle and discussion and, yes, controversy.
Stephen, last week, your attorneys, well, you have cooperating attorneys in Illinois who are on the team with the CCR, and your attorneys in Illinois filed a lawsuit in federal court in Champaign, Illinois, against the University of Illinois because the university was asked, and it's supposedly a public university whose documents belong to the public. That's a democratic principle that we established in the 60s. And they asked, pursuant to the Illinois Freedom of Information Act law, for the documents pertaining to your firing, precisely those documents from people who were pressuring the university, threatening to withhold funds, or political activists who were threatening the university. So those documents were requested, which is the legal right of your defense team and of you to see, and the university turned them down. The university said, "It's too burdensome. There are thousands of them, and it's too much work for us to go through." Your attorney then said, in their estimation, they could go through these documents in a week or two, and their refusal to give them to you was in bad faith. And I wanted to ask you what you expect to find in those documents and what your attorneys are going to be doing with them.
Well, first of all, we feel that it's a matter of great import to the public interest that the university administration has arbitrarily taken an action that has had negative consequences for the reputation of the university and for its ability to function normally. As you know, the university is undergoing a boycott, et cetera, right? So its normal functions are being disrupted. And so we feel like it's a serious matter of public interest that the citizens of Illinois, the taxpayers of Illinois, right, have access to, you know, the emails that might explain why this decision was taken, right, and what thought processes went into making that decision. It's hard for me to speculate what those requests might turn up, but I'm pretty confident that they're going to turn up plenty of things that contravene the traditions and practices of faculty governance.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's true. Given that they know what's in it, but we don't. So they must suspect that it ain't going to help them. Stephen, you've written six books as a young man, which is quite impressive. I wanted to ask you about one of them. I think that our listening audience would be interested in it and may want to go out and get it. Tell us a little bit about Israel's Dead Soul.
Okay. It has a cheeky title, of course, a provocative title, but it's a critique of the discourses of Zionism, particularly of liberal Zionism, of the particular notion that we've heard a lot about since 1967, that there's something inherently pure about Israel and the Israeli state, and that unbecoming acts of violence or excess are thus damaging to that state's purity and thus damaging to the soul of Israel. And so we hear a lot of narratives about the soul of Israel being torn asunder, which are very melodramatic, right? And, you know, my critique is not just of the Israeli soul, but of the notion that nation states embody these kinds of human and humane feelings in the first place, that there is no soul to be corrupted, that the soul of the nation state, particularly a nation state like Israel that was founded on the displacement of 700,000 people, right, was violent in the first place. And, you know, so to wring your hands about the state of Israel's soul is also to blind yourself to very important forms of history.
Well, you know, I'm remembering the statement of Christopher Kennedy, the chairman of the Board of Trustees at the University of Illinois, after he organized the board to rubber stamp the chancellor's firing of you. And he said, we don't want to hurt the guy. We just don't want him around here. Well, I can understand why Christopher Kennedy may not want you around there. But I wanted to ask you about his first statement, we don't want to hurt the guy. You know, here's a entitled, wealthy man, the chairman of the Merchandise Mart in Chicago, which he inherited from his grandfather, Joseph Kennedy. And here he is discharging a young professor with a wife and a two-year-old who now no longer has no home, doesn't even have any health insurance. What are your plans? What are you going to do now that they've cut you free? You can't go back to your old job, and you're literally out in the cold. It's 28 degrees in New York City. What do you do? What are your plans? What happens to somebody that gets treated like you've been treated?
Okay. First of all, if I can just say quickly that it wasn't Mr. Kennedy's decision to make about whether the guy was around or not. This is a man who was appointed by the governor. All right, so I have much more of a right to be there than he does. I was appointed by a democratic process of faculty input. You know, he was plopped into his position, so I don't know what kind of right he has to comment. But in terms of what's next, I guess as long as folks are kind of interested in hearing about and discussing this situation, I'm going to be happy to continue to travel and to be in conversation with them. I'm still pushing for reinstatement for the university to honor its end of the contract. I'm keeping my eyes on the job market just to see if there's any possibilities. But given the severe damage that the university has caused my reputation, you know, any potential job prospects outside of reinstatement at the University of Illinois seem far-fetched at this moment. So I'm just going to really, as cliche as it sounds, take it day by day and try to keep my chin up and try to make the best of it, which is much easier to do with the tremendous friendships that have developed out of an otherwise awful situation.
Before you go, I wanted to ask, are there any websites if people want to continue to follow what's happened to you or come to your support? What should they do?
There's a Support Salita Facebook page that has a lot of good information. It has a link to a Fundly site where folks can provide donation if they're interested. And it's always updating articles and events. It's a good hub for all kinds of information.
Thank you, Professor Stephen Salita, for being on Law and Disorder. It's really an honor to be able to work with you and for the principles which you stand. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The largest organization of psychologists is set to conduct a review that may not be independent into whether it colluded with or supported the government's use of torture in the interrogation of prisoners during the Bush administration. On September 19, 2011, we interviewed Dr. Stephen Saltz and reported on health professionals being front and center and complicit in the U.S. policy of torture. The torturers relied heavily on the opinion of psychological professionals who provided sanitation and rationalizations for the infamous torture memos. Psychologists were directly involved in the supervision, design, and execution of torture at U.S. military and intelligence facilities. This is a violation of state laws and professional ethics. These health professionals that were involved with torture still hold their professional licenses to practice. We welcome back Dr. Stephen Saltz, former president of the Psychologists for Social Responsibility, to talk more about the review being conducted by the American Psychological Association. Dr. Saltz is a psychologist, psychoanalyst, and public health researcher in Boston.
Stephen Saltz, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here again.
Now, Stephen, I know you're with a group called the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology. They had a recent response to the American Psychological Association's decision to, as you said, at least in the press release, I think, start an independent investigation of the American Psychological Association, looking at their role in the Bush programs of detention, enhanced interrogation, torture, etc. And I know we've had you on the show before in 2011. Can you give us first a little background, and then why has this all of a sudden come up?
Okay, the very quick background. I mean, at this point, I think we all know that there was a program of torture in the Bush administration, CIA, and the Defense Department at Guantanamo. What's known as the psychologists were central to it. In the CIA, they designed the torture. They consulted in the Defense Department at Guantanamo, so-called behavioral science consultation teams. And essential to the legal protections. The Justice Department torture memos basically said that if a health professional, a psychologist or physician is there and says that the interrogation won't cause severe and long-lasting mental harm, then it isn't torture, then even if it causes harm. So in other words, their presence was a get-out-of-jail-free card. And this seems, as far as we can tell, to be have been central to the Bush administration's plans to indemnify themselves while engaging in torture. So the American Psychological Association apparently worked with the Bush administration to provide protection for the psychologists who were involved. The ethics code had been changed in such a way that it allowed psychologists to disobey the ethics code and follow governmental orders. This was actually done right before 9/11, though it was passed after 9/11. And then they convened this blue ribbon panel, the Psychological Ethics and National Security, or PENS Task Force, to decide if involvement in interrogations was ethical. And they had a majority of people from the military and the intelligence establishment who had been involved in interrogations during this time. So we have been concerned for many years that they were complicit in various ways. Now, James Risen of the New York Times just published his new book, Was It Pay Any Price? And one chapter in there provides direct documentary evidence that APA officials were working with the CIA and the White House to manipulate the ethics code to apparently allow psychologists to participate.
It's an amazing story. I mean, I always want to tell our listeners, you know, Dr. Soltz has been on this since almost the beginning, going after particularly that committee at the American Psychological Association and the fact that it was staffed with essentially people close to the CIA, military, et cetera. And it really been on this case. And then I guess the Risen book came out, Pay Any Price, which, as you said, has this chapter. And they particularly focus, I think, on somebody who has died since then, a behavioral researcher, I think named Scott Gerwer. And what was the story with him?
Scott Gerwer was a RAND researcher who had top security clearance and consulted to the CIA. There were emails between Gerwer and various, he died in 2008, I believe it was, and sometime later, James Risen got access to emails that were on his computer. These included a number of emails, hundreds, I gather, between the APA and White House and CIA officials. So this is a partial collection because we only have it from the perspective of stuff that the Scott Gerwer got, and so there probably are a lot of other emails that aren't present. But they document a pattern of close working relationships, and they provide for the first time a real smoking gun on this PENS task force.
And the smoking gun is what?
Well, first, Kirk Hubbard, who had recently retired, he was CIA top scientist, top behavioral scientist in the CIA. He was the person who would introduce Mitchell and Jessen to the CIA. James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen were the former military psychologists who designed the enhanced interrogation torture program for the CIA. And Hubbard's the one who introduced them, and appears to have been involved and has been a strong supporter of the enhanced interrogation program ever since. Hubbard had just retired from the CIA and reports to a bunch of people, including Jeff Mumford of the APA, that he's now working for Mitchell and Jessen. So he went from the CIA to the CIA's torture firm. And the response he gets from Mumford is, oh, good. We want to let you know that we just released the PENS report today, and your views were well represented there by a very carefully selected members. We want to thank you for coming up with the idea last year, and we hope you're pleased with the results, just as pleased as we are.
Let me back up for a second because I want our listeners to understand. There was a committee appointed from the APA to look into the APA's role, is what I recall from your work in the past.
Well, to look in, to decide on the ethics of interrogation, whether psychologists participating in national security interrogations was ethical, was consistent with the APA ethics code.
Right. So this report comes out of there, and the emails essentially are thanking someone who involved in the CIA in some way. Is that right?
Yes, the CIA, and was currently working for the CIA's torture firm.
And that was the committee that I know you went after that
that
was stacked with government people, essentially to prove what they were doing, what the APA was doing.
Yes, and it was staffed with people from military and intelligence establishments, and the membership was kept secret for a year. It was actually told to members of the Council of Representatives, but when press or the APA members would ask about it, they were told that they were confidential until a reporter obtained the list from Congress.
You know, it always has been amazing to me that the APA played this role of actually the architects of the program. I mean,
weren't the architects of the program. They were the ethical protection for the program.
They were not
directly involved, as far as we know, in torture. They were more involved in doing what the CIA and the White House wanted in terms of manipulating ethical understandings.
Yeah, ethical and legal cover. But now, in the wake of Risen's book, Panty Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War, the American Psychology Association has directed what they call an independent review of their role. Your organization is suspicious of how independent this review is going to be. Talk to us about that.
Well, first, we and many others like Amnesty and Center for Constitutional Rights have called for an independent investigation of the APA for a number of years. And so we're glad that the APA board has recognized the need. They appointed a Chicago attorney who is a specialist in public corruption and former federal prosecutor conduct a review. We are cautiously optimistic, but we have some concerns. I mean, first, it's inappropriate for the APA board to appoint its own investigator of whether APA did something wrong. That's hardly an independent investigation. But we also have concerns. The mandate that they gave was unclear. Namely, on the one hand, it says that he can range from questions, but all the questions they raised were phrased in such a way, you know, did the APA aid torture? And the answer in some sense is no, they didn't aid torture. What they did is what the CIA and White House wanted them to do, and it wasn't directly about torture. It was about currying influence with the powerful that happened to help the powerful people who are engaging in torture. We are hopeful that the investigation will be wide-ranging and comprehensive, which is what's needed. And the third concern is that they appointed a special committee of the board who will liaise with Mr. Hoffman, will make resources available, will encourage staff to talk to him, will make documents available, et cetera, and also will receive the report and write a response to it. And this committee consists of the president-elect, and the CEO. And we're especially concerned about the CEO's involvement there because the staff who allegedly were involved in working with the CIA and White House were people working directly under him. He was responsible. If the accusations in Risen's book pan out, you have to look at his office. And there are only two possibilities. Either he knew what these staff were doing, or he didn't know. And both of them are pretty damning.
Why?
Well, if he knew, that means that he approved of it. If he didn't know, it means that he was incompetent. He wasn't monitoring, because this is something that went on for years. I mean, this has been the issue that has most divided the APA over the last decade of controversy. It's led to bad press around the world. In some circles, you know, psychologists are viewed as those torturers. I mean, it's been a huge, huge issue. If he doesn't know what his staff were doing and his top staff were doing about it, then that's a real problem.
We're talking with Steve Solds from the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology, and he's responding to the APA's announcement of its, quote, independent investigation. And he just mentioned a person, the CEO of the APA, who has been appointed as part of this investigation, I gather, or at least the board to supervise it. And, of course, he was there at the time when all of this went down. His name is Norman Anderson, according to the press release. And Steve is addressing that issue. Steve, one other issue you raise in the release is about the APA statements that it's against torture. And it, I guess, does this constantly. What do you make of that? What's going on here?
Well, I think there are two ways of thinking about it. One, there's often been a lot of wiggle room, and if you do very close readings of it, they often don't quite mean exactly what they say. But the second thing is that what was most needed by the intelligence community was that it was ethical for the psychologist to participate in this, in interrogation. Once you have the psychologist present, we've been told by people from the military and the intelligence, because we have a lot of allies in that community, they say all that's needed is for the psychologist to be there. And once they're there, it's everything they do is secret. So, you know, you can have all the fine pronouncements against torture you want, but you have no way of enforcing them because whether that what they do is secret. So, you know, once you allow them there, that's all that's really necessary.
I mean, this is really a question of why are you doing this? I mean, President Obama has said we're putting all this behind us. We have to look forward, not backward. So why do you want to rake up the mud on this? Can't we just look forward?
Well, several things. One of the key people who was in the Bush White House during this time who's implicated is Susan Brandon, who is now a top official in President Obama's high-value detainee interrogation group. So there's continuity there of personnel. And we also don't know for certain what's going on in some of the Obama interrogations because the Army field manual that's supposed to be followed has an Appendix M that's full of loopholes that allows sleep deprivation and isolation, for example, to occur. So we don't know for sure what's going on in this administration, but we also know that if the Republicans win, torture will probably come back. You know, a lot of the Republican politicians have openly endorsed enhanced interrogations, and they're close allies with the people in the CIA and et cetera who were behind the program. So we can't assume it's behind us. And this is the time when things are a little bit calmer for the profession to sort of say, we're not going to go down that road next time, and hopefully the public as well.
Yeah, it is shocking to me that they went down that road. Of course, you've been on their backs for a long time with, you know, at least public results, but maybe not internally. And I think the point on Obama and Annex M is important. Annex M is the one that still allows sensory deprivation, isolation, and sleep deprivation, and of course, taken together can amount to a very serious violation of either torture, law, torture prohibitions, or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. It came up at the recent hearing on the U.S. compliance with its obligations under the Convention Against Torture. They said one of the people on the committee reviewing the U.S. asked the U.S. representatives, why don't you just get rid of Annex M? Why is that in there? And what you're bringing out is the problem with the Obama is whether it's actually using this or not, which, as you said, we don't know, is it's left the door open to the next administration to do it by leaving this stuff around, by not prosecuting anybody, and, of course, by the APA here as well.
Yes. As long as you have impunity, it will return.
I want to go back to the history a little bit, because in reading a bit about it and remembering what we talked about last time, in the APA, the American Psychological Association, you guys have a set of ethical rules that tell you what's ethical and what's not. Now, apparently, there was a point after 9/11 where these were modified within the APA, the ethical rules?
Yeah, it does appear that the modification started before 9/11. We don't know why. There are accounts that it had to do with forensic psychology. I'm not sure I trust them. But in any case, they were passed after 9/11, and they stayed in effect for many years. One of them was removed a couple of years ago. Two others are still in effect. The one that was removed just a couple of years ago, long after the Bush administration, was a clause that basically said you can follow if the ethics code conflicts with law or orders, you can follow the law or orders. It basically was the Nuremberg defense that I was just following orders. The Council of Representatives have been concerned about this from the very beginning, from 2003, and yet year after year, they never did anything about it until, as I say, long after the Bush administration. But there is another couple that are in there that concern research, one of which removes the requirement for informed consent. Now, since the Nuremberg trials, when Nazi doctors were executed for conducting unethical experiments, informed consent has been the backbone of human subjects research. And yet the APA put in this clause that said basically, if laws or institutional regulations, that's a very broad category, institutional regulations, don't require informed consent, then psychologists don't have to do it. So if my institution, my drug company says I don't need to have informed consent, I can give drugs to anybody and without informed consent. I mean, now the federal government might get in the way for some things, but the point is that there's no reason why APA should allow people to get rid of informed consent for anything but the most trivial and harmless research. And they've never explained where this comes from, and it's still in effect.
Oh, that's remarkable, because it goes right through, you know, everything about a person's autonomy. I mean, it even goes into our forced feeding area where, you know, the Americans say they can force feed without the consent of the person, et cetera. It's remarkable.
And they can conduct, now, according to the APA, they can conduct research.
Where is this going to go? I mean, I know you've issued the release. You've been on this for many years. What are your hopes? And Risen's book on this was a big break, because even though you've been on it for years, having Risen, the Times reporter, write about it, I think, must have made the APA wake up a little bit.
Yeah, I think it was a game changer. And there should be more revelations in the coming weeks and months that will further document some of the issues there. We hope that this is a real investigation. We have offered our support to Mr. Hoffman and our aide, and we're going to work with him if he's interested. And we will try and take this as far as possible to try and understand what went on and what's the evidence. But it also depends on the APA. You know, are they really going to open up their emails, for example? Or are we going to discover, oops, we had a failure in our email backup system a couple of years ago, which is my fear. You know, that happens so often when you have these investigations that somehow, oops, everything got destroyed.
How many members are there in the APA?
Full members, about 80,000, give or take.
Yeah, so it's a big organization, right? It's the biggest, right? There's nothing else like it.
Yeah, biggest mental health organization in the world.
Yeah. Where can people go to find out more, to get either your writing on it or others?
Our coalition website is ethicalpsychology.org.
Ethicalpsychology.org. Well, Steve Saltz, thank you very much. I know you've been in this fight for many, many years, and as you said, hopefully the Risen book and the revelations are a game changer. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you very much. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.